Good, so thank you for trying that experiment with me. It's good to see you all this afternoon. The title of the talk is Seeing from the Heart, Part 2. Or it might be Not Trying to Manage Your Experience. That might be the title of the talk too. I haven't decided yet. So last Friday I was at the airport taking a flight out, and I was just getting ready to run the security gauntlet, and the TSA employee who was at the little desk where my line was, I looked at her watch and she said, it's time for my break. And so she just walked out, and it was like, well, great. And so eventually my line got through. But I noticed that I was having a case of grumbling mind. And and the lines really weren't moving very fast. And actually, I wasn't in a rush. I had gotten there in my obsessional way with plenty of time. So there was no big deal with having to wait to get through security. But what I did was drop my attention into the heart, what we were just doing, and just looked out from the heart space. And I noticed it was a completely different experience. You know, the commentary in my mind was just quiet. And all of a sudden it was like I saw the people in front of me not as impediments, but as people who had their own hearts. And there was a kind of community in the security line. It was an odd place to feel a sense of community. Last week I told you about the clue that I got from the 19th century Tibetan teacher Shabkar. On the one hand, kind of working the Christian side of the Buddhist side of the street, and then from the Christian side of the street, the Eastern Orthodox folks who talk about dropping the mind into the heart. So I've really been playing with dropping the mind into the heart and inviting people that I work with to do the same. Marcel Proust says that the voyage of discovery lies not in seeking new vistas, but having new eyes. So this dropping the mind into the heart, from whatever tradition, is just a way to play with getting a fresh look, a fresh take on things. A woman with whom I had been working in therapy told me about an experience she had. She said she was putting on her makeup, and she was looking out through her heart, and she said, "Oh, that woman looks tired." And she said, "You know, it wasn't like, you know, oh, she's got a lot of wrinkles on her face now and was trying to cover them up. It was like she just saw herself with a sympathetic eye. Oh, that woman looks tired." Somebody who was here last week wrote me and said, "I've been looking at the world with my heart space this week, from the sunflowers in my garden, to my puppy, to my mother-in-law, to the neighbor who refuses to get his septic system off of our property, to the political situation." It's just getting worse, you know, mother-in-law, septic system, political situation. "What I have found is that looking in this way creates the space for me to observe it and hence be more curious about it, giving me more time, even if it's just half a second, to connect instead of instantly label." So this last weekend I was flying down to San Antonio. I've never been to San Antonio before, to do some work at a Catholic retreat center and theological seminary called the Missionary Oblates of Mary Immaculate. You know how these Catholic orders have initials after their names, like the Society of Jesus, S.J., the Jesuits, and the Benedictines, or the OSB, the Order of St. Benedict. These folks are the OMI, the Oblates of Mary Immaculate. And it was really a lovely experience to be teaching down there. The word oblate means offered. The Latin is oblatus, and it's these folks have offered themselves in missionary work all over the world. They started in France in the early 1800s. And there was actually a bronze frieze there on the grounds of six of these oblates on horseback. And they had their clerical garb on, their crosses on, and their clerical collars. And the inscription said, "The Cavalry for Christ." And these folks were just riding all over the Southwest, and they were evangelizing the folks that they found there. Mexicans, Native Americans. I was walking around exploring the grounds from the Heart Center, just looking at what was there from the Heart Center. And, you know, there were the obligatory Stations of the Cross. And it was really interesting to see those, not as a tourist or as an art historian, but from the Heart Center. And there was this lovely, lovely statue, a seated statue of Jesus holding the hand of a woman. And this was a garden that was dedicated to parents who had lost a child. And there was such tenderness in this sculpture. There was another unusual sculpture where Jesus is seated at the table of the Last Supper, and there are 12 kind of just seats around the table. And so visitors there would come and have their picture taken with Jesus at the table, and it was all kind of sweet. It wasn't a quiet monastery because there were people kind of coming in and out, but there was a stillness there. They had Wi-Fi, but it was more like the old days before everything was wirelessly connected. There was just, it was, the phrase that came into my mind was, it was a place where prayer was valid. That's a phrase of T.S. Eliot's. It comes from his poem in the Four Quartets called Little Getting. And I want to read you just a little piece of this poem. "If you came this way, taking any route, starting from anywhere, at any time of any season, it would always be the same. You would have to put off sense and notion. You are not here to verify, instruct yourself, or inform curiosity, or carry report. You are here to kneel where prayer has been valid. And prayer is more than an order of words, the conscious occupation of the praying mind, or the sound of the voice praying." Eliot was visiting a little English village called Little Getting, which is about 30 miles outside of Cambridge. It was a place where a group of Anglicans came together in community in the 17th century. And it's just, it again, like this retreat center, is just a sweet, sweet place. The total population there of Little Getting and Greater Getting and Steeple Getting, even today, is 362. You know, it's just one of those little English villages. Walking around the grounds of the retreat center, there's a strong Marian feel to it. There are these statues of Mary, and Our Lady of Lourdes because of the French connection with the Oblates, but also Our Lady of Guadalupe with the Hispanic influence. And on Sunday there was an enormous outdoor mass in this grotto dedicated to these two apparitions of Mary. And there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Hispanics there. And these looked to be working class folks. This was not white folks' church. This was a different kind of experience. And there was such a palpable tenderness. There were lots of children, of course, there. But the whole feel of the place was very receptive. And because I had been teaching, looking from this heart space all weekend long, it was especially sweet being in that space with all these churchgoers. There was a little indoor chapel associated with the retreat center, with this outdoor grotto. And inside the chapel was, as is typical in Catholic churches, the large priest host in a gold monstrance. It's the Blessed Sacrament. And so I found myself sitting in the pew just as you are, but looking from the heart space at this host, this bread, this body of Christ. Again, I don't really have any words for this other than to say it was a very different experience. There was a kind of... Christians talk about real presence. A kind of communication, communion, communion. That was just on order. That's not there with the ordinary consciousness, the ordinary thinking mind. I was teaching out of some of the people that I've been teaching from here over the last several months, Cynthia Bourgeau and Stephen Bodian and Francis Bennett. And inviting people to unhook and step back from whatever the contents of their minds were, just to make that little bit of step back, just to get a little bit of distance, and then to feel into their bodies, much as we were doing in the meditation this afternoon, and then to rotate consciousness as we just did, so that there's both looking out from the heart, but there's also being seen into from the heart. And there were some particular passages that I pulled out of the Christian mystic Cynthia Bourgeau's writing. And I want to read these just little aphorisms. Concentrating attention in the heart is a sensation-based physical practice, not just a spiritual attitude. This is a physical practice. From the physical heart, looking from the physical heart, being seen into the physical heart. Putting the mind in the heart is a rewiring of consciousness. Do you notice how different it feels to look in this way? There is consciousness, and that is to say, the machinery of the brain. Consciousness is more than the brain. The mind is more than the brain. But it is a rewiring of the brain and consciousness. This is a shift to an entirely different operating system, which is anatomically located in the heart. This is a 21st century Christian mystic woman who's talking about a whole different operating system. This is an upgrade in our operating system. If our normal operating system is the binary operating system, you know, warm, cold, short, tall, smart, stupid, that's our normal way of walking around the world. This is a different kind of operating system. And she goes on to say the teaching of Jesus emerges from this different operating system, from a higher consciousness that is inaccessible to human beings in their ordinary state of mind. She's saying that if you want to understand his teachings, you have to join him in this different operating system. And the access to it, the portal, is through the eyes of the heart. It's dropping the mind into the heart. You will not be able to understand the depth of his teaching unless you do this, because you have to join him in this different kind of operating system. And then finally, she uses a Greek word, kenosis. Kenosis, the great gesture of Jesus' self-surrender, catalyzes changes in our neural wiring through attention to bodily sensation. Now, the word kenosis, you know, if you ask probably 98% of the Christian world, do you know the word kenosis? Probably, you know, most of them would not. Most of us would not. It's a Greek word which means emptying, and it's maybe the most important word in the New Testament. Paul uses it in his great passage from Philippians when he says, let this mind, this different kind of mind, be in you that was in Christ Jesus, who did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, to be held on to. Hear the clinging. But here's the word kenosis, emptied himself, taking the form of a, and the word in Greek is doulos, it's slave. He took the form of a slave. He emptied himself. So what Paul is saying and what Jesus was teaching was we have to empty ourselves of our normal way of seeing, our normal way of looking, if we're going to come into something different. So emptying is the wisdom path. It's the heart of the One River Wisdom School, Nashville. That's what we're practicing, is this emptying. And it is the portal into what Jesus called the kingdom. What Buddhists would call true nature, our true nature, our natural state, who we really are. Thomas Merton would have called the true self, what the Quakers would call the inner light. This inner light is from the heart, and it's from the physical heart space. The Hebrew word here is hevel. It's emptying. And it's the big word in the book of Ecclesiastes. When Ecclesiastes says, some of you will know this, when he says, everything is vanity. It's actually a poor translation of the word hevel. What he's really saying is everything, moment to moment to moment, is emptying. It's arising and it's passing away. It's here and it's gone. That is the nature of the ising of the divine. It's here and here and here and here. Everything is emptying. That means that everything is impermanent. And what you take to be yourself, that too is impermanent. What's not impermanent is this emptying. So the folks that I was working with on this retreat were just a lovely, lovely group. I easily entered. They've been working over the course of this year, and I just got to be with them for this retreat. And one of the things that we were doing was some of the internal family systems work that, if you've been here, I've been talking about. And so one of the people I was working with was a lawyer, and she was saying that it's just a complete frustration to her that she can never get her office organized. It just seems that everything is just falling into disorganization all the time. And I asked her if she'd like to do a little work around that. And she said, sure. So I asked her if we could speak to the managerial part of her, the part of her that just wants to get this stuff organized. And she looked at me a little cross-eyed, like, I'm not really sure I want to speak to the managerial part of me. And so I said, let's be with that. Again, if the heart of meditation is just allowing everything to be the way it is, then we want to allow that. I'm not so sure I want you to see my manager in action. So we were just hanging out with that for a little while. And the manager said how vulnerable it felt at even being seen. I said, so let's just hold that in this heart space. We had been doing this looking from the heart. So we were just holding that vulnerability in the heart space. And, you know, she began to kind of relax a little bit. And then we could inquire what the manager's experience was like. What it was like in her body. And she said, you know, it's like this grip around my throat and, you know, kind of how old it was. And she said, oh, this, I've been managing my family for a long time, ever since I was a little girl. I was the manager of the family. And then we could ask, well, you know, how does the manager like its job? And this is when she began to cry. And this is, she said, I'm not a crier. At the end of this, she said, the manager hates its job. It's so sick of managing the hell out of everything. This is the opposite of meditation. If meditation is letting go of managing our experience, letting go of manipulating our experience, the manager is trying to manage everything. And so we were just holding her grief at living in the manager's space all of her life so that she really never gets a vacation. And so we could ask after a while, you know, what would the manager like to do? And she said, the manager would really like to go to Hawaii. And that was really about as far as we went. We didn't even go into the parts of her, you know, that feel fear, that feel lonely, that feel terrified, needy, in pain, unworthy, unlovable. We didn't even try to touch that material at all. But at the end of the retreat, she came up to me and she said, I just got to let you know. That was a really big experience for me to touch that. And she said, I'm going to be holding my manager in my heart when I go back. One of the neat things about being at this retreat center was that they had these cards of icons. And one of the brothers there was an icon painter. And there was an icon that I had never seen before, and it was an icon of Jesus making his descent into hell. The mythology of this is, you know, the crucifixion's on Good Friday, and then Holy Saturday is sort of the descent into hell, and then there's the raising from the dead on Easter. So the mythology is that he goes into hell and he frees the imprisoned spirits. And by the way, using the word mythology, I'm not saying it's untrue, right? I'm just saying it's a story. You can believe it if you like or not at several different levels. But anyway, the icon is he's down there and he's reaching out to Adam and Eve who are in these two coffins, and he's got them by the wrist. And I thought, that's an interesting detail. He's got them by the wrist. So I did some reading about this particular icon, and it said that in Jesus' time that you could free a slave by, freeing them from one master, but now they're your slave. Or you could buy them from someone and pay another fee, And if you paid that second fee, then they were really free. And the way you let them know they were free was you took them by the wrist. Then they knew they were redeemed. They were really, really free. The Buddha said, just as all the oceans of the world have one taste, the taste of salt, so too all the religions of the world have one taste, and that's the taste of freedom. When we look through the heart space, we allow ourselves to be seen not with the thought factory, not with the dualistic binary mind, but allow ourselves to see and be seen from this space. That's the space of freedom. That's the way we actually get to freedom. It is as though, and again, you got to check this out for yourself, and that's what the Buddha said about all of his teaching, by the way. He said, don't believe this just because I say it. He said, be like a goldsmith who's assaying gold and who's scraping, say, a golden pot to see if, is this really gold or is it just bronze? He said, test the teaching in your own experience and see if this is the case. I think this is the big revolution that's going on in religious experience now. It is not enough just because some religious authority says this is the truth and you got to believe it. And if you don't believe this, you're not a part of the club. What's happening now is you have to test it in the balance pan of your own experience and see, does this speak to me? Is this true in my own experience? And that's really where the action is. Last piece of this story. So I had done my work on Saturday, and on Sunday I decided to go into San Antonio because I'd never visited there, because some friends had said you really need to check out the River Walk in San Antonio, and it really is just remarkable. This river goes through the center of the town, and the way that they have built up along that river. It sort of feels like Venice in a way if you've been to Venice. And it was just very cool being in that space. But before I went on the river walk, I went to the Alamo. I thought I'd be a good tourist and I'll go to the Alamo. And but I went in looking from the heart space. And I was stunned to find myself weeping inside the Alamo. I was not expecting that at all. I think if I had gone in as a, just your garden variety tourist, that, you know, you see the Alamo and it's really kind of smaller than you would have expected, and, you know, this is where Davy Crockett died, and this is where Jim Bowie died, and, you know, all those kinds of historical details. But it was as though I had tuned into the grief of that place. That would not have been available had I not been looking through the eyes of the heart. And then I did the Alamo, and then I did the river walk. And doing the walk from the eyes of the heart, I felt completely unburdened. I was walking alone. I normally would have been doing that with Kathy. And I was certainly aware of thoughts of her walking with me. But it didn't feel sad. It didn't feel full of grief. It felt altogether unburdened and light. That was really the gift of being with the Oblates. And that was the vibe of the grounds of the seminary and the vibe of the retreat center. It was as though whatever you bring to this place, whatever you experience in your heart. Seeing in this way, your heart can hold all of it. It has the capacity to be with whatever your experience is. With the sweet parts of the weekend, they just got sweeter being seen and held in the heart space. And then with that moment at the Alamo where, you know, there's just like the grief of this place that was still available at a certain vibratory level. It could be held. I did not have this capacity 40-some-odd years ago when I visited outside of Munich the Dachau concentration camp. I don't think I've ever been in a place that felt as constricted and dark and burdensome. I was sharing this with a friend here in Nashville earlier today, and he said, I know somebody who was a part of the liberating American forces who opened up the gates at Dachau, and he said, that man's life has never been the same. It has marked his experience ever since that day. I wonder what it would be like to go to that place looking through the eyes of the heart and letting, as one is able, that amount of suffering to see into our own hearts. I think that's what the capacity of a great soul like Jesus is able to do. They have a heart as wide as the world. That's a human possibility. That's a possibility for all of us. We just have to let go of managing our experience, manipulating our experience, and instead looking at our experience, whatever it is, and let it look at us as we are able to bear it. If this feels like too much for you, step back from it. Don't do it if it makes you feel too vulnerable. But play with this. Experiment with this. This is the place where prayer has always been valid. So that's it for a moment. So you might like to invite your breathing to come into and flow out from your heart space. And thinking of someone who is dear to you. And they see from their heart space, and they invite you to look into their heart space. And they say to you, may you be free from fear. May you be free from obsession. May you dwell in peace. May you dwell in love. And we offer these same wishes from our heart space to this beloved one. May you be free from fear. May you be free from obsession. May you dwell in peace. May you dwell in love. And just check in with your heart space and see what it's like to exchange this benevolence and think of your teachers, your guides along the spiritual path, your spiritual companions. Those still in form and those who are formless, who have gone over to the other side. And receive their words to you. May you be free from fear. May you be free from obsession. May you be filled with peace. May your heart be filled with love. And we send these same wishes to our teachers, our spiritual guides. Great beings, great souls. Send your wishes in your own words. Then we send these wishes to strangers, people in airports, people in traffic, people in the news. May you be free from fear. May you be free from obsession. May you dwell in the heart of peace. May you dwell in the heart of love. And we send these wishes to difficult persons. Persons who vex us, scare us. Challenge us and see what it's like to say, may you too be free from fear. Altogether free. May we be free from compulsion and obsession. Old controlling habits of mind. May you dwell in the kingdom of peace. May you dwell in the land of love. And see what it's like to send these wishes from your heart. What happens to your own heart as you do this? Finally, we send these wishes out in widest possible circles to all beings, beings in bodies, beings who are formless beings. May all beings be safe and protected, welcomed and loved, filled with loving kindness, held in loving kindness. May all beings know the beauty of their true nature, and be free. We dedicate the merit of our practice this afternoon to the welfare of all beings, to the arising of freedom, and to the ending of suffering. So a couple of announcements. There'll be a Dharma Friends group meeting tomorrow at the Brentwood Public Library. That's from 10:30 to 11:30. And that group is going to start reading Michael Singer's The Untethered Soul, which is really a lovely beginning to practice book. You don't have to have started the book to come to the group. I'll be doing the Contemplative Eucharist at St. Augustine's Chapel at Vanderbilt this Sunday, 8 a.m., and then the 5 o'clock meditation group that meets at my home on Sundays. That will be resuming this week, number 10, Peach Blossom Square. I'll be leading retreats at St. Mary's the weekend of September 8th and October 20th and December 1st, just so you can begin to think ahead. So thank you for your generous attention and your generosity in the Dharma baskets and at the support place online at One River, Nashville. Hope you have a great week. See you next week.